B3. Number 21A.
All right. We come to point 9. Understanding leads to oneness. We have seen really that what constitutes misunderstanding are human beliefs. Human beliefs, as we know, are always dualistic. They are man-made. And therefore, these man-made concepts do not give us an insight into the true values of understanding. We accept through these dualistic human beliefs values that are not real values, but only then when we go higher to the third value and introduce the value of mind, that then understanding draws the line of demarcation between facts and concepts. Then we know what are just human values and what are real values, what are truths, what are facts, what is reality. When one touches understanding, and understanding is a quality of God, then one touches the one valued logic in a certain way, namely that then from the point of view of mind, one is reflecting along the line of mind. Mind reflecting on itself is always reflecting on its own nature, therefore has always its own one value, because it's just one mind reflecting on its one nature, and therefore always sees and is aware of its own likeness, and sees its likeness everywhere. Therefore, it knows only ideas, knows not even a distinction between spirit and matter. And here we come to this interesting point that we can take that standpoint of understanding and either look at it as that which draws the line of demarcation between facts and counterfeits when we look at it from the lower level of human conception, or it appears as a very as a something very different. Understanding does not know a distinction between spirit and matter. So understanding itself, when it is not translated to a lower level, does not know a line of demarcation. You see that? Because mind reflecting on itself will never be aware of an opposite, and therefore will never know that there is a dualistic belief, because that dualistic belief dwells in a very different realm. So here we could say that when we stay within the value of understanding here, that matter disappears under the microscope of spirit. We don't even need any more to make that distinction between spirit and matter, so that we realize here something important, that what has been regarded as dualistic beliefs and concepts, that they are only states and stages of consciousness, nothing per se. Mr. Ely says that spirit and matter are only states and stages of consciousness. They are not two values per se. And therefore we have in the textbook this apparently contradictory statement or statements. On one hand she says earth is matter and defines earth through matter for material sense. And the very same earth, she says, is a compound idea for spiritual sense. So one phenomena called earth has two, can be regarded from two standpoints, and every time we have a different logic. If we regard earth from the standpoint of material sense, then the logic is that earth is matter. If we regard the very same thing from the standpoint of spiritual sense, then we don't have matter, then we have a compound idea. Again, you can see standpoint is the most important point. Change of standpoint, is that what we have to consider? Not change of phenomena. Here we can understand that well-known statement of Mrs. Eddy, where she says, Jesus beheld from where? In science. So she defines your level, your standpoint. Says, Jesus beheld in science what? The perfect man. And now, you can see in the same sentence, she takes in now another level, and therefore another logic. Who appeared to him where sinning mortal men appeared to mortals. So the very same phenomena, man, is from one standpoint perfect man, from another standpoint a sinning mortal. Therefore one can see, you see, that we cannot get along just with that static, dualistic logic. We have to use a very flexible and evolutive logic that can take into view, in one sentence, 1, 2, 3 levels or standpoints from which to look at reality. That has always been brought out in the Christian Science teaching. You know how Bicknell Young used to say that matter is just a perishable concept of the imperishable. So the reality is imperishable, that's a value. But when we look at it from a perishable concept, then matter is perishable. So the same thing is at the same time imperishable and perishable. You see, it breaks the law of identity, but it does it only then, and this is important, when we change the level of our logic. If we don't change the level of our logic, then these statements are wrong. They are contradictory. Or Paul would bring that out too. I mean, all these mystics have somehow seen these things, you see, but because they were not really trained in the logic yet, their vocabulary and their language, therefore, was not really bringing out this modern sense of logic. Paul, I didn't want to name him as a mystic, but he says something similar, what mystics also say. The material universe he regarded really as the spiritual universe, but only looked at through a glass darkly. So when he was saying, you don't see the reality of things, it is only because your glasses are not clear, are not transparent. It is not the object that is not perfect. Being is perfect, but if you put on dark glasses, you only see through glass darkly, and then you see something else. The appearance of the universe, but not the universe itself, is then different. Or the well-known statement from the Apocalypse, which Mrs. Eddy gives, that she sees the 7 vials full of the last plagues as being the sum total of human misery. And then John the Revelator said, come, look, but what do you see? The lamb wedded to the bride of the lamb, huh? Love wedded to its own spiritual idea. So the moment he had changed the standpoint, he saw the law of compensation of which Mrs. Eddy speaks in that paragraph, and sees that it has full compensation, so that instead of the sum total of human misery, we see the perfect idea of love. So always, can you see, it's a question of, are we looking from the human concept or from the divine standpoint? And at once, the logic changes. So at that point, where we are at the point of understanding and try to see only mind's own ideas, then it is no more necessary that error must precede an understanding of truth. Then it is possible that truth, in its own self-reflection, only sees its own ideas. That's then the one-valued logic. So that there we begin to see that man is really God's consciousness of himself, and there we can reason constantly in the just one-valued logic. There is no duality enters in there anymore. And then we have, in some way, overcome the two valued and the two conceptional logics. And we have touched just the one valued logic, understanding. Understanding only sees its own ideas. All right. Then we come to point 10. Three valued logic. I just make a very small step forward again, very small. I take little step by little step so that I can put the subject over. And here I want to show how the two valid logic is now in the world in the process of being resolved through introducing actually a third value. This overcoming of the two-valued logic was really of great interest already to the classical philosophers of last century, like Hegel. He was the one who first tried somehow to overcome the two-valued logic. He didn't quite succeed, but it's interesting that he gave the first indication for it. He could see that any thesis had an antithesis, the opposite, that for anything which we state, we also can take the opposite standpoint, which is the antithesis. So his endeavor was to put thesis and antithesis into one. You see, it was a trying to find a one-valued logic, and so he put thesis and antithesis together in a synthesis. So he synthesized this opposite and tried to find a higher answer, but he too had to do something. He had to somehow leave the level of argumentation and put it on another level of arguing and make there a synthesis. But then, naturally, he found out, because he stated a new thesis through this synthesis, that for that again, there can be again an antithesis. And that for this new thesis and antithesis, there is again a new synthesis. So he couldn't quite get out of that dualistic sense. But what he did is something quite important. He really laid in this way the basis of modern dialectics, and Marx was building really his material dialectics on Hegel's presentation of thesis leading antithesis, and then bringing that into a new synthesis. And that is why those trained in Marxian dialectics, like they are trained now, especially the young people in the Eastern countries, they are terribly good in arguing. They corner you constantly. Whatever you say against their thesis, they have an antithesis, and then they bring it all nicely together and convince you that there is a synthesis. And from there, if you object against something, they are so well trained that they know again the antithesis and make again a synthesis. And being well trained in it, they are really very good debaters. But that doesn't make duality one. They haven't really found the solution, because they are still arguing with the human mind and with the human system of preference, which by nature, by definition, is dualistic. But these forerunners really then found a very serious contemplation when, in a quite different field than philosophy, namely in the field of physics, one found out, 1925, that actually the law of identity does no more hold good. Because in atom physics they found out that matter and energy are actually exchangeable. Therefore, that the same thing can be either one or the other. Can you see our third law? The third law. Remember, of the excluded middle, where we said A cannot be A and at the same time not A. But physics found out that that is possible. That an electron can be either at the same time energy or it can be quantum matter. So suddenly they were confronted with a phenomena that was breaking classical logic, and so they had to find a new logic in order to show or to get on their subject. So here you have a hard and fast example of how the identity principle was lost. The law of non-contradiction didn't play anymore. The law of the excluded middle was no more right. And therefore, they had to find a logic with more than two values. And this complicates then the situation quite a bit. I will talk about it later on. At the same time, around about the same time, they found out that it is not so as classic logic tells, that there is the logic of cause and effect, but that there is actually in the subatomic field the law of uncertainty, the uncertainty principle. And they have to work with the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle more or less says you cannot rely that a certain cause leads now to a determined effect, as you have in mechanical physics, where you are absolutely sure that if you push a book over the brim of the table, you can be 1,000% sure that it will fall down. That's the law of determination. But in the realm of atom physics, this is no more true. There it is only probable, but not sure, that it will happen according to the law of determination. So that you have to take into account the uncertainty principle, namely into account that something can be or happen or not happen. So, also, at that time, they found out something else which would break the law of identity. Namely, you know, we said in the classical logic, you go out from object and subject as the fundamental opposite. Subject, object, and that between subject and object there is an unreconcilable gap. And suddenly they found out, when they were investigating the atom, that this is not true either, that by the fact of observing an electron, they would change the position or the way of the electron. That the mere way of observing changes the object. See, in Newtonian physics, You can look at the chair as many times as you like, and from whatever side you like, that object remains an object, and it has its identity. No more in the subatomic field, where the way of observing, where the subjective approach, the subjective choosing of which method you want to approach the electron, it changes the position and the course of the electron that takes place. Can you see what happened? They suddenly began to see that subject and object is one and not two. And naturally, this is the old definition of Schelling, that he said identity is really subject and object at the deepest are one on the deepest level of reality. And that's naturally true. I mean, in the infinite one, subject and object is one, is identical. You don't have an infinite God, and outside of his infinite God and his reflection, a universe that is somewhere over there, and in between there is a terrific gap. Subject and object is one from the point of view of being. And now they found that even in the level of material science, you see that actually subject and object are not two anymore. But as classical logic is built on the fact that subject and object are two, you see that therefore this logic is no more true even in atom physics. So I have just given you a few examples of what we have been discussing before, namely that they had to introduce a third value, just as we had to introduce a third value, that we could see that in the classical belief you have fact and counterfeit, and then introduce the third value of understanding, which would show which one of the two is now the real. Just as in physics, they know now if they approach something in one way, they will find matter. If they approach it in another way, they will find energy or a wave, an electronic wave. But you can see it's now a question that spirit and matter have become states of consciousness, and no more states that are somehow, that have somehow their identity in the material realm. All right. We go to point 11, cybernetic logic. Actually, this would be another example under point 10, but because it is a very clear and a very important aspect, I take it as a separate point of discussion. It is that which we can better understand than if we delve down into atom physics, where I don't understand anything and you may not understand very much. We just know how much these people tell us in their books. But when we come to cybernetic logic, we really find there's something which we can easily grasp and gives a very good example to see how really the logic that Mrs. Eddy used is also showing forth itself now in the field of cybernetics. I state you in an abbreviated way how Professor Günther here in America has stated that cybernetic logic, and has seen that we must have a completely new concept of metaphysics, that the old classical concept of metaphysics is now no more valid. His reasoning is like this, and it's a great help for us. He says, what is the classical logic? He says it's a clear distinction, as we have already stated, between what? Between the I and, opposite to it, the world. I and the world. This is the great line of demarcation. What is the I? He says the I is reflection. I'm thinking, I'm reflecting, I'm engaged in a process of reflection. Reflection with an X. With an X in it, huh? Reflection. Not to reflect. Huh? It's a reflex process. So it is reflection. Huh? And the opposite is therefore the object of that reflection. And there is nothing in between. Therefore, they are unreconcilable opposites. Consequently, there are only two values. All right. From there it goes on and comes now to the third value in the cybernetic system, which he calls information. We would call it understanding. He calls it information. So that he has three values. First, as I said, the subject. Second, the object. And the third value, information. Now, what does it mean? How does he arrive at that conclusion? He arrives at it from his knowledge of cybernetics. And what is cybernetics? I just tried to summarize it. A cybernetic system can perform actions of intelligence which were believed to pertain only to people, to reflecting subjects. That's what a cybernetic system does. Subjects. That's what a cybernetic system does.